Welcome to the Science Podcast for August 19th, 2011. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Stuart Wills. This week, how species distributions are shifting with climate change, the search for habitable exoplanets, and how to enhance secondary school education.
Plus, our usual wrap-up of some of the latest science news from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
For some time, we've known that the distributions of many species, either geographically or in terms of elevation, have been changing in response to climate warming. But a team led by Chris Thomas of York University, which reports its findings in this week's Science, has determined that those species' range shifts are happening far more rapidly than previously thought. What's more, the shift in range for a given species tends to be closely tied to the amount of warming in the region in question. Thomas spoke with me about the work and its implications.
What we did was to look at all of the responses of species to climate change in the sense of how far they have moved their distributions towards the poles and to higher elevations. And what we found was that the rates of change were surprisingly 2 to 3 times faster than had previously been recognized. And particularly for shifts away from the equator towards the north and the south pole, we found that species had been moving at around 16 to 17 kilometers per decade, which actually equates to an average rate across all species of about 20 centimeters an hour.
Now, what made you embark on the study in the first place?
Well, it was quite a long time since about 2003, 2004, when the last sort of review meta-analyses had been carried out, pulling the literature together. And since then, there had been the IPCC reports, which had updated the state of knowledge, but they hadn't actually done a formal analysis or meta-analysis of the literature. And, of course, a lot of studies have been published in the last 5 to 10 years, and so that we felt that it was time for an update to identify what changes are taking place, how fast are those changes, where are they, and provide a revised view of rates of response of species to climate change.
And now you describe the study as a meta-analysis in which you've incorporated data from a number of different studies into your analysis.
That's right.
How did you choose your data and what were the most important variables that you took into account?
Well, we tried to find everything we could by using standard search terms in bibliographic databases. What we then did was we got a very large number of potential papers to look at. And what we wanted to do was to choose only those studies that had looked at a fair number of species and had not selected the species in any way by their response. So if somebody had studied all of the birds in a region, that was okay. If someone had studied one or two species of bird which were known to be responding to climate change a great deal, then we wouldn't include that study because potentially it could include a sort of bias in the results.
And so the results that you produced were rates per decade. Over how many decades did this data span?
Studies varied. Most of them were over 20 to 40 years.
And you've sort of answered a little bit of this so far, but what was your exact methodology in analyzing all of this data?
Well, our response or dependent variable was the amount of change in the distribution that had taken place in the study. And we analyzed that in relation to a number of predictor variables, but that included how much warming had taken place in the region during that period. And the thing that's really kind of links these responses to climate change is that the more climate warming took place in a region over the period of study, the greater the response, the further they moved towards the poles or the higher the elevation species moved to. And then we did a second thing, which was to calculate for each region, given the amount of climate warming that has taken place, how much further north would you expect them to have to move in the northern hemisphere to keep at the same temperature as the places that they used to live in historically? And so that gave us a sort of method of calculating an estimated latitudinal shift that species would have to undertake to keep up with climate change. And again, we found that the observed response, how far they had actually moved, was correlated with how far we expected them to have moved, again, linking the range shifts to the levels of regional warming.
And I remember reading something in your paper about how some of these species actually moved in opposite directions to what you actually expected, either closer to the equator or lower in elevation. Was this number of species statistically significant? And what sort of conclusions were you able to draw from these?
Okay, well, yes, you're absolutely right. There's a huge variety of responses. So everything I've said so far relates to the average when you take the average across lots of species. And some species have actually moved further or faster than you might have expected, and others have moved far less rapidly. Now, in terms of what's statistically significantly more species have moved towards the poles and moved in the opposite direction. But we're finding a quite large minority, if you like, of species that are doing the opposite. And, of course, that's not entirely surprising because we know that all sorts of other things, that changes that are taking place in the environment, will also be affecting species. So if you imagine land use change, habitat loss, and so on, there might be a lot of species which, let's say, in the northern hemisphere, the northern edge of their distribution, the climate may be becoming warmer and therefore potentially more suitable for them. And in theory, they might be able to expand. If, on the other hand, land use changes are resulting in all of their habitats being lost, the species may actually decline. And so the net change in where the species occurs is a consequence of a whole series of balancing pressures, of which climate change is just one of them. So when you average across lots of species, on average, they shift with the climate, but some might retreat because some other pressure is causing them to retreat, whereas others shoot ahead because maybe the climate's improving for them in a particular area, but some other change in the environment might also be favorable for them.
Now, with all of these different variables that you have here and different responses, it seems like the findings here are not entirely cut and dry, and the interpretation here is not entirely cut and dry. What do you think is the greater significance of your findings?
No study is entirely cut and dry in the sense that at the moment the data are predominantly from Europe and North America, with just a very small scattering of data from the southern hemisphere and the tropics. And so in terms of obtaining a much clearer global picture, it's very important to obtain data from these other regions. Because most of the data are from Europe and North America, when you're in the temperate zone and in cooler regions, and also from data on tropical mountains, in both of these sorts of situations, temperature is known to be a really important controller of biodiversity patterns, of the distributions of individual species. However, in much of the tropics, where of course so many species live, we do know that precipitation and moisture availability are really critically important determinants of distributions. And as such, we don't have nearly such good information, well, we have virtually no information on how changing precipitation and changing evapotranspiration, that is to say, the evaporation of moisture that does fall in rainfall from the vegetation and from the ground, how the level of drought that is associated with increased temperature and changes in rainfall patterns, how that's affecting species in the tropics. So that's still a really big hole that needs to be plugged. On the other hand, is it cut and dried from the point of view that within these studies we did look at, yes, we are finding that species are responding more in regions where the climate has changed more. So I think that that's pretty compelling. It's just that we would prefer to have a wider range of data from additional parts of the world. Though the implications do to some extent go beyond where the paper gets to, because as species are moving on average as fast as the climate, it does make some of the projections that a number of species may be at risk of extinction, for example, because of climate change, become more credible, because we actually know that species are moving in the direction we would expect, given that the climate is changing, and at about the same speed as expected because of the climate.
Chris Thomas, thank you so much.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Kerry.
Chris Thomas is senior author of a new paper on how species distributions are shifting in response to climate warming.
In a News Focus article in this week's Science, Udijit Bhattacharjee writes about the ongoing search for planets outside of the solar system, particularly planets that might be capable of supporting something like life as we know it. Here's Udijit Bhattacharjee.
So this is a story about how the search for life beyond the solar system has now turned into a mainstream scientific enterprise. Or rather, I should say, is turning into a mainstream scientific enterprise. And it's founded on the last 15 years of discoveries of different kinds of extrasolar planets.
And you sort of alluded to this in saying it's turned into a mainstream enterprise. I gather that however hot or mainstream it might be looking now, exploring for these exoplanets hasn't always been the royal road to riches and respect in astronomy.
Absolutely not. And you've hit upon sort of the grand theme of the story, because it's remarkable how far this field has come. Back in the early 90s, scientists were convening meetings on extrasolar planets, but I recently heard a very well-known NASA scientist named Wesley Traub describing one of those meetings when he would not tell his colleagues that he was indeed going to attend an extrasolar planet meeting. And now, of course, there's, you know, dozens and dozens of posters and papers presented at these meetings, and several are held every year.
And I guess one thing that has changed in particular are the techniques being used to find these things. How have those changed? Could you take us through some of those?
Sure. So now there are sort of four techniques that are used to look for extrasolar planets. The first of these was used in the mid-90s to discover sort of the first few extrasolar planets, and that's what's known as the radial velocity technique. So when a planet orbits a star, the planet's gravitational pull makes the star wobble slightly, and so you can sort of detect the wobble in the star if you look at its light very carefully. And so that's what gave away the presence of the first extrasolar planets that were discovered. Then came another technique known as the transit technique, in which the light from a star dims slightly as the planet moves in front of it, in essence, kind of casting a small shadow and therefore reducing the amount of light that you see from the star. And so several planets have been found in the last 10, 15 years using that technique. There's another technique that sort of has become popular since about 2002, 2003, which is the use of gravitational lensing, where the light from a distant star is bent ever so slightly by a star in the foreground.
So kind of putting Albert Einstein into service
there. That's exactly right. And so if you have a planet circling this foreground star, then that planet actually exerts an additional influence, and it exerts that influence periodically as it's orbiting the star, and that's how you can detect the planet. And then finally, in 2008, Science Magazine published sort of the first real images taken of an extrasolar planet, because now the technology is good enough that you can actually take pictures of a few of these.
So that's kind of a formidable technical achievement right there, just because the star would be expected to kind of drown out the planet, I would think.
You're exactly right, because starlight is so powerful that anything that is sort of in the glare of starlight, it just can't be detected, and you need very special techniques to tease out the presence of a planet.
And I guess now there's also an entire space-based mission looking for these exoplanets, this Kepler mission?
Yes, this has been a very successful mission, which was proposed in the 90s and started making observations since the March of 2010. It was launched in May of 2009, and in the last 2 years, it's already delivered about 1,230 candidate planets, which now have to be followed up on using ground-based telescopes to actually confirm whether those planets are for real or if they're noise or if there's something else.
Did you say 12,000?
Actually, I said 1,200.
Oh, 1,200.
Yeah, 1,200. And they expect to find many more. I mean, because...
Well, out of those 1,200, how many have they actually confirmed or planted?
They have, to date, I know, 17 of these have been confirmed.
So there's a long way to go.
Exactly, yes. But I think that the pace of confirmation might get accelerated as technologies improve.
But your story doesn't just look at the search for exoplanets, but at so-called Earth-like exoplanets, or maybe better stated, exoplanets that might have the right conditions for supporting life. How does one sort of define such a planet?
Well, that is the holy grail of this field. So the definition, I think, is still being developed for a habitable planet, because any definition we come up with is based on what we know about Earth. But a planet that is terrestrial, in other words, that's rocky, a planet that is not too close to its star and not too far, in other words, a planet that has just the right kind of surface temperature, you know, where life might conceivably survive, and the presence of liquid water is also considered to be one necessary condition for a planet to be regarded as habitable. And so when people talk about Earth-like planets, they're really talking about Earth-sized planets with Earth-like density and Earth-like temperature, not necessarily at the same distance from their star as the Earth is from the Sun, because if you had a star that was smaller and less powerful than the Sun, then you could presumably be a little closer to that star and yet have a livable temperature.
Okay, so we kind of know generally what the parameters are for where this planet would be relative to a star of a certain size and, you know, various other things about an Earth-like planet. Suppose we start finding these, and I guess a few of them have been found. How do we learn a little bit more about what they're actually like, about whether they actually could support life? Because there's a lot more than just these conditions.
Sure. You've asked a very good question. What do scientists have to do, or what can they do to learn more about these worlds? Well, the step that they're taking right now is to start preparing to study the atmospheres of these planets. They're starting out by studying atmospheres of larger planets, because that's what the technology of today allows them to do. And so this project, which is coming online next year, called the Gemini Planet Imager, there are several others like it. There's actually one other like it out of Europe called Sphere. These two projects will be looking to do detailed spectroscopy of the atmospheres of large planets so that scientists can understand what kinds of compounds, what kind of chemicals exist in those atmospheres.
Okay, so where is all this headed? I got the sense from your article that the field is kind of counting on some important new instruments, important new telescopes that have been shelved, maybe. You know, where are we going with this?
So one goal is to look for biosignatures, or to look for compounds like dimethyl sulfide and certain other signatures that would indicate the possible presence of life and metabolic reactions on that planet. But in order to do that, lots of astronomers were counting on the development of this mission known as the Terrestrial Planet Finder, which would be a spaceborne observatory that NASA had conceptualized a few years ago and is still funding, although at a very modest level. So for all practical purposes, the Terrestrial Planet Finder and DARWIN, which is a similar project dreamed up by European astronomers, these two have been shelved for at least the near term. Nobody expects them to get much traction over the next decade. And so some people are disappointed, because that means waiting for a longer time than they wanted to in order to do the detailed studies to actually detect the presence of life elsewhere.
But presumably the planets themselves will wait for us to find them.
Absolutely. As an astronomer who's a pioneer in the field told me, we've waited for centuries just to find planets outside the solar system. What's a few more decades to find life?
Yudhijit Bhattacharjee, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Yudhijit Bhattacharjee writes about the search for potentially habitable exoplanets in a News Focus this week.
Exoplanets. everyone wants to find a way to create better high school teachers. But how? Thus far, the field has been hard-pressed to come up with teacher development approaches that lead to quantifiable and reliable gains in student achievement. Now, a paper published this week in Science reports on an experimental study in teacher training that seems to have produced substantial increases in measured student performance. The secret? Coaching teachers to help them improve their social interactions with students. The paper's lead author, Joseph Allen, talked with me about the work.
What we were setting out to do was really improve teaching that takes place in secondary schools. And it's obviously an important topic that a lot of people are concerned about. We sought to do that with a coaching approach that uses the web and videotape and consultants working closely with teachers over time to do that. And what we found was that over a two-year process, we were able to improve teaching to the point where we saw very significant gains in student achievement compared to students whose teachers had not participated in the program.
So what are the current systems in place for teacher training right now, and what is it that you saw as insufficient about them?
Well, you know, what's really striking is that at the secondary school level, that is for middle and high school students, there really aren't programs to enhance teaching that have been rigorously documented and shown to improve teaching across a broad array of, you know, classroom content. So there are some programs that are designed to improve math instruction and that have curricula for math instruction and are effective. But there's really very little out there that says, how can we improve what teachers do with high school and middle school students? In fact, secondary schools are a place where we're in desperate need of interventions. That, you know, 1 in 4 ninth graders that start school this year will not graduate with a high school diploma in 4 years. And so we've got this huge problem that we're losing kids, especially in terms of their motivation in secondary school. And that's what we were really trying to address.
So tell me a little bit about this coaching program that you came up with.
Well, it's an interesting program in that what it does is begin by giving all the teachers in the program a small video camera. And they, every couple of weeks, videotape one of their classroom sessions in its entirety and then send it off to our labs at University of Virginia. And we have master teachers who have a very precisely laid out schema by which they view that tape and look to see what that teacher's doing in ways that it can be improved to reach adolescents more effectively. They then take what they've learned, they pull a few clips of that tape out with some questions for the teacher. The teacher answers those questions. They have a little back and forth on the web, and then they have a 20 or 30 minute phone conversation. And we repeat this every couple of weeks throughout the school year, so that what happens over time is two things, really. One is the consultant really develops a relationship with the teacher. You know, the program is called My Teaching Partner, and the idea is that the teacher does not feel alone, so alone in the classroom anymore. What we were hoping would happen is that teachers actually begin to change their teaching. They see things they're doing, and they see ways of moving their everyday practice in a more positive direction, and we see them changing their teaching, and we see students responding.
So what variables in particular were you targeting for improvement?
We were targeting two different kinds of variables. One of the variables that we've put the most emphasis on is something that we call regard for adolescent perspectives. And the idea here is that we really want to tune what's going on in the classroom to the adolescent's needs. And the thing about adolescents that's a little bit different than elementary school students and certainly different than adults is unless you have a motivated adolescent, unless you have an adolescent who wants to learn, it really doesn't matter much what you do as a teacher. And so a big part of what we were targeting and watching teachers for was, could they form a relationship with the adolescents in their classroom that would really engage those adolescents, that would really increase their motivation and their desire to learn? And that's what we found happening. And then the other thing, the other outcome we were really interested in was we wanted to see real changes in student learning. And so we used the high-stakes student achievement tests that, you know, all students in the state of Virginia take. They weren't modified in any way for our program. And we said, look, if we're making a difference, we should be able to make a difference on this acid test that the schools are held accountable for.
And I know what really struck me in this manuscript was the focus on interactive learning and, you know, making the teachers and the students a lot more interactive together. And so you were able to implement this training system within the classroom. Can you tell me about basically how you structured this testing phase, how many students and how many teachers you had?
Sure. We had over 2,200 students over the 2 years of the program, and the program ran in 78 different classrooms, 78 different teachers across 12 schools and 6 districts. So we wanted it to be something that wasn't just going to work in one school and in one specific kind of setting and with a few teachers. We wanted it to be something that would work across a broad array of teachers and would be generalizable.
Okay, so what were your results?
Well, our results were that we saw changes in the teacher behaviors that we were targeting, both in their attentiveness to adolescents, the adolescents in their classrooms, the quality of the relationship they formed, the degree to which the adolescents were interacting with one another and sort of becoming engaged. But most importantly, we really did see results in achievement test scores. The average student in a classroom that had a teacher that had been in our program tested at the end of the year 9 percentile points higher than the average student who was not in the program. So instead of being in the 50th percentile, they were in the 59th percentile. So they jumped ahead of sort of 10% of the students not in the program by virtue of participating in this.
Were you able to get an idea for any more of the longer-term results?
You know, we followed these students up, and where we got our effects was actually in the second year of our analysis, of our evaluation. And what's interesting about that is that that was the year after we finished the intervention. In the first year of the intervention, in the first year of the program, we saw changes in teacher behavior. We saw students becoming more engaged by the end of the year, but we didn't see the achievement gains that we were hoping for. And it seems that what happened is teachers did get better, but by the time they got better, the year was almost over. But in the second year, we were done with the intervention. We were not doing anything with the teachers other than collecting videotapes from them for our evaluation purposes. And that's where we actually saw the changes. So it really suggests that they took with them what they had learned and brought it over, not just to a new year, but to a whole new class of students.
And I'd imagine that it would be, you know, a bit of a time commitment from all of the teachers involved. How feasible do you think this would be on a large scale?
Well, it is a bit of a time commitment. It took probably about 2.5 days of total time over the course of an academic year. But that is actually no more of a time commitment than teachers typically put into in-service training that's offered by their district. And as I said, most of the training that's offered has not been documented to significantly improve teaching. So if we offer it as our approach to in-service training and say instead of these one-day, one-shot deals that teachers go and mostly roll their eyes at and come back and say, yeah, I learned a little bit, but I don't think it's going to change anything I do. If we have this ongoing integrated approach to training, it doesn't have to take any more time than what teachers are already spending. As far as generalizing and expanding the program, that's something we're very much interested in doing. The challenge is that it's a program that really depends on consultants who understand this approach to watching teachers and have got some skill in terms of intervening and forming partnerships with teachers. That's something that we can absolutely train people to do, but we're starting small and we're going to have to gradually expand in a way that lets us serve more teachers without diluting what we're doing or without having it morph into something very different than what we're doing now that might not work as well.
Joseph Allen, thank you so much.
You're quite welcome. It was a pleasure.
Joseph Allen is lead author of a new paper, An Interaction-Based Approach to Enhancing Secondary School Instruction and Student Achievement. Also of education interest this week, a special section of news and review articles on the benefits, challenges, and policy of early childhood education. You can find the section at www.sciencemag.org/site/special/education2011.
Finally today, David Grimm, Science's online news editor, is here to give us the lowdown on some of the latest stories from our daily news site. First, David, suicide bombing bacteria.
Right, sir. This is a case of trying to turn one dangerous microbe against another. In this case, one of the dangerous bacteriums is known as Pseudomonas aeruginosa, which is a type of bacteria that's actually responsible for some pretty nasty stuff in humans. It creates what's called a biofilm, which is basically when a bunch of bacteria sort of glom together, and this can be very dangerous for causing infections in humans, and is also very dangerous for cystic fibrosis patients. And researchers have obviously tried antibiotics and other drugs, but this study is about trying a different type of strategy, and the trick was to see, could they turn E. coli into sort of a suicide bomber that would infiltrate the Pseudomonas bacteria and literally explode and kill all of them.
Okay, well, what sort of bioengineering did they actually do here?
Well, they took advantage of some of the strategies that Pseudomonas uses to glom onto each other. One of the cool things that Pseudomonas does is it's able to detect the other bacteria in its environment, whether that's either the same bacteria or other foreign bacteria. And so the first thing researchers did was they took the genes that are responsible for this and they put them into E. coli. So now all of a sudden this E. coli is able to sense Pseudomonas in its environment. Mm-hmm. The other thing that Pseudomonas does is it creates this toxin called pyosin, which kills off all the other bacteria. So when it senses other bacteria, foreign bacteria in its environment, it releases this pyosin, and that's not toxic to itself, but it's toxic to the other bacteria. So they also put this gene for pyosin into E. coli, but they tweaked it a bit. So now the pyosin was toxic to Pseudomonas. And the final thing they did was install what they called a suicide gene. When E. coli sensed Pseudomonas, the first thing it would do was start filling itself with this pyosin, but then this final gene basically causes E. coli to explode when it's surrounded by a Pseudomonas and when it's totally full of pyosin. It releases this toxin, and the idea is that it kills all these Pseudomonas bacteria, anything that's in the vicinity.
So how effective was this bomb?
It was actually very effective. What the researchers did was they actually tested this in basically a petri dish in the lab. They threw a bunch of Pseudomonas in there, and they threw their engineered E. coli in there. And what they discovered was that this suicide bombing E. coli was able to kill 99% of the Pseudomonas, which is pretty good.
Well, yes, but that means 1% left over. Couldn't it just come roaring back?
That's one of the criticisms one of the experts, outside experts, raised in the article. The other problem is that they haven't tried this yet in an animal system. And E. coli can be dangerous to us, mm-hmm. especially if it's outside our gut. So you don't want to give somebody, especially a cystic fibrosis patient who's already in a lot of trouble, you don't want to just fill their body with E. coli. Also, scientists aren't clear what effect pyosin would have on it. Even though related compounds have been used as food preservatives, we just don't know what the effect would be of a bunch of E. coli exploding in our body and mm-hmm. releasing pyosin. So obviously a lot more testing needs to be done here, but it's a really cool proof of concept.
And next, some new suggestions that evolution might be a bit more predictable than we'd thought.
Here. Right. Well, Stuart, this study also deals with another microorganism, or at least a microscopic organism. It's a worm, a microscopic worm known as C. elegans. And the whole point of the study is to figure out, is evolution predictable? In other words, if we rewound the clock on evolutionary history, would the same mutations happen over and over again? Would organisms develop in the same way, or is evolution much more random than that? And the researchers in this study had a really interesting way to test that with these C. elegans worms. And what's interesting about C. elegans is it tends to have two different life paths that it can go down. A young worm can either mature in 3 days, reproduce, and die within 2 weeks. So it's a pretty normal life cycle, at least for these worms. Or it could enter what's called a dour larva state. And that's what happens when these worms get really stressed out, when they sort of sense that something's wrong with their environment. The temperature doesn't feel right, there's too little food, or they're in really crowded conditions. They enter this dour larva state, which is basically a state where these animals don't eat and they can survive very stressful conditions for sometimes months at a time. Well, what's interesting that's happened is in the lab strains of C. elegans, especially the ones that have been grown for a long period of time, they seem to have lost this dour state or the ability to form a dour state. Specifically, a 50-year-old lab strain that the researchers looked at here almost never goes into the dour state. And the researchers say, well, that kind of makes sense because in the wild, it makes sense to go into a dour state because there you really will have a condition where there will be no food available or you get too crowded. But in the lab where you've got nice researchers sort of feeding you every day, you know, that's really not going to happen. So over time, it seems like these worms, at least in the lab, have lost the ability to do this. And when the researchers looked under the hood, what they found was that a couple of genes had been deleted that seemed to explain why these worms didn't undergo the dour state. So
nothing terribly surprising.
Nothing terribly
so
surprising. You know, pretty standard story. You know, organism doesn't need something anymore. It sort of jettisons it and it sort of evolves a different type of trait or lifestyle. But what was interesting was when the researchers looked at some other C. elegans worms. In this case, C. elegans worms that had actually been the same strain that had been on the ill-fated Columbia space shuttle that had crashed in 2003. These worms also had lost their ability to go into the dour state. And lo and behold, when the researchers looked under the hood, they found the exact same genes had disappeared, even though these worms were not related to the other worms that they found. Well, that's interesting. And even more interesting is the researchers looked at one more species of microscopic worm. And this species actually split off from C. elegans 20 million years ago. So not is it only not even very related to C. elegans, it's very far apart from it on the evolutionary tree. And it's so far apart that it doesn't have the exact same genes as C. elegans, these genes that the researchers had fingered as being responsible for the dour state, but it has equivalent genes. And the researchers found that the genes that were the closest equivalent to the ones that they found in the other worms that had been deleted had also disappeared in this worm.
Well, I guess I'm wondering, though, how surprising this really is. I mean, the animals were under the same kind of selective pressure. They were responding to overcrowding. Wouldn't that mean mutations in the same genes?
Well, it's surprising and it's not. It's surprising because the researchers say there's about 50 to 100 genes that by deleting them, you could potentially remove the dour state. So why is evolution only acting on this one or two genes? That's why they're saying evolution seems to be somewhat predictable, because if you've got these very different circumstances and the same genes are disappearing every time, it suggests that there is some sort of logic to evolution. It's not as random as we thought. But on the other end, it does kind of make sense that these genes would have been deleted, because what the researchers say is a lot of the other genes that could potentially have been deleted have a lot of other important functions in C. elegans. They're really important for the animal's development and the physiology. And so evolution wouldn't have necessarily acted on these genes or quote-unquote removed these genes, because that may have killed the worm. Evolution may be sort of constrained by which genes it could act on, especially in this particular circumstance.
And finally, a replay in a far-off solar system of something that may have happened in ours billions of years ago.
Well, Stuart, this is another case of sort of rewinding the clock and seeing if the same thing happens over and over again. But this doesn't deal with microscopic worms. This deals with planetary collisions in alien solar systems. One of the going hypotheses about how the moon formed was that a Mars-sized object smashed into Earth, broke off this huge chunk of Earth, and this chunk coalesced into our moon. And what this new study is saying is that something very similar may have happened in a solar system about 50 light years away. The sun at the center of this solar system is a white dwarf. It's actually about the size of our Earth, so much smaller than our sun. And this white dwarf is known as NLTT43806. They never give these suns very interesting or exciting names anyways. But this white dwarf is very unusual, because most stars that researchers have analyzed out there in the cosmos have a lot more iron in them than aluminum. In fact, they have an iron to aluminum ratio of about 10 to 1. But this star has a lot more aluminum in it, which is really unusual. And what's interesting about that is planets like Earth also have a ton of aluminum in them, for one. And this star also has seven other elements that are really common in Earth-like planets. And taken together, the researchers say this really strongly suggests one scenario. And that scenario is that this white dwarf had two planets orbiting around it, and that one of these planets crashed into the other one, just like what happened to Earth a few billion years ago. And this collision ejected all of this aluminum-rich material from this planet basically into the sun. It came off the planet, and eventually it was drawn in by the sun's gravity and fell into the sun, and that could explain the curious mix of elements we're finding in that sun.
I don't know. It sounds to me like they're inferring an awful lot here. why would it have to meet an impact? Couldn't it just be some other planetary body that fell into the sun, into this star? Or?
That's a really good point, Stuart, and it does seem like a lot of speculation just from measuring some ratios of elements in an alien star. But the researchers are pretty confident about it. One expert does say, however, that there may be other potentially simpler explanations. For example, an asteroid could actually have smacked into this sun, and the asteroid could have been filled with very similar elements, and that could explain what the scientists are seeing. Unfortunately, it's a little hard for them to test this theory, because the astronomers would really need to get a good look at this foreign sun. And as of right now, the sun is about 50 light years away. They haven't been able to do that yet.
Okay, Dave, what else are you looking into for the news site?
Well, Stuart, for Science Now, we've got a story about some surprising cognition in elephants and a cool video to go along with that. Also a story about a way to turn old drugs into new drugs with a new genetic database. For Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we've got a story about the UK severely slashing the number of PhDs that it's going to be offering in the future and what the impact that will have on science in the UK. Also, an interesting story about whether researchers should refer to themselves as coming from Taiwan or Taiwan, China. A very big debate going on and a lot of comments on this insider, so I encourage readers to check that out. Finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's Science Live is about oil drilling in the Arctic. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org. Where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. And that wraps up the August 19th, 2011 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Stuart Wills.
And I'm Carrie Klein. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.